This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The mass media landscape shifts around us daily. Twitter fuels a revolution in the Middle East. And then we hear about another old guard publishing company that announces layoffs or a bankruptcy. But even as the landscape changes, journalists persist in some of their worst habits. How the media covers a crime still depends in large part on the race and the socioeconomic status of the victim. And the stories of those who have little or no political power too often remain ignored. For the rest of this program, we're going to take a look at four recent and continuing news stories. The string of murders in Rocky Mount, the case of a Monroe, North Carolina teen who went missing in Baltimore, a nonviolent prison protest in Georgia, and the attack and sexual assault of CBS News reporter Lara Logan in Tahrir Square in Egypt. Joining me from NPR in Washington is Keith Woods. He is Vice President for Diversity in News and Operations at NPR. With me from NPR's New York Bureau is Jill Filipovich. She is a New York-based lawyer and blogger for the site Feminist. In the studio is Brett Chambers. He's a lecturer in English and Mass Communications at North Carolina Central University. Keith, Jill, Brett, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's start with the Rocky Mount murders. In January, law enforcement officers in Rocky Mount in eastern North Carolina found the 10th body in what they believe may be a serial killer case. Nine women, one man, whose bodies were found since 2005, all African-American, all poor. Some were drug users, some were prostitutes. The families of these victims have complained that the police and the media didn't pay enough attention when the bodies first began appearing. And I know, Brett, you have worked in newsrooms and have guided coverage of stories like this. Tell us how the status of a victim plays into the decision-making in a newsroom.
Well, first of all, we have to know there is a victim. And that's one of the challenges sometimes is that newsrooms are especially a local newsroom, because that's the other thing. It's like we don't want to lump everybody together, even though that's how it's perceived sometimes, that the media is one entity. Right. And there are a lot of different delivery platforms nowadays, and a local newsroom is different than a national newsroom. And one of the things that we think about is that, and we used to say in the newsroom, is that all news ultimately is local. And so that when you think about this market, the Raleigh-Durham market, 23 counties, that's a lot of information to sift through and decide what to put on your air. And the competition between especially two of the stations in this market, WRAL and WTVD, is a very intense competition. So when you look at the competition, you look at the amount of information and the diversity of the audiences that the newsrooms have to deal with, the race, class, the location, the when it happened, who tells them, there's so many different factors. And I think that that's one of the problems in trying to analyze this whole situation is that there's so many moving parts that go on in making those decisions that there's no single bullet answer to it.
What would you say in your experience that the race and class and gender of an individual does matter? It's somehow that maybe nobody says, oh, they're black, who cares? You never hear that at the meeting. But somehow you've noticed in your experience, have you, and I'm asking, that when somebody comes from a lower socioeconomic status, the likelihood of its coverage declines.
I would say it depends on your tribe. I was talking earlier about tribal politics, really. And people tend to gravitate to things that are in their purview also. So if you have a newsroom that doesn't have diversity, then they're not going to know about anything outside of what the makeup of that newsroom is. And that's one of the things that I know that the stations in this market have been very conscious of, because they recognize that there's such a high concentration of minorities in this market, African-American, Hispanic, and it is huge. So these stations can't, from a competition standpoint, ignore those numbers.
Keith Woods at NPR, let me ask you, when it goes to taking a story that would otherwise be essentially a local story, a drunk driving accident or a string of murders, a murder, and bringing it to the national level, how is that decision made, and to what extent do you think class, race, and socioeconomic background matter?
Well, I think in historically you have to even the most objective view of this has to conclude that both of them matter. Getting journalists to particularly the key decision makers within newsrooms to see that those are in fact the factors that go into it. It's a much more difficult proposition. But the decision often to take a story from the local to the national level has to do with a sense of resonance to the nation. And as much as we can make a lot of those decisions based on some objective measures of how people are talking or tweeting or otherwise communicating about a story, more often than not, it also stems from our gut feeling about whether or not this story will resonate. And for people of color and for poor people in this country, it often is not deemed resonant enough to take it nationally. And I agree with Brett that the thing that you have to make sure we do in these conversations is separate out the media into its small pieces, because in fact, many times local news organizations are in fact covering these stories and giving them the kind of attention that they need, even as police might be failing them locally, or even as the communities themselves might fail to bring forward the kinds of leads and other elements of stories that present themselves for journalists to cover.
CNN and GQ magazine have covered the Rocky Mount murders. Otherwise, not much national attention. I think very little from NPR. Is it a national story? Should it be getting more, Keith? Let me start there. At the national level?
I think in principle, yes. I don't have an analysis of all of the coverage that it's gotten here or anywhere else to be able to compare it, but a story of that level, especially as it has unfolded and presented itself as more than individual stories, clearly ought to be the kind of thing that comes to the attention of the country.
Jill Filipovich from Feminist, how does the fact that some of these victims in the case have been identified as prostitutes, do you think, factor into the coverage?
I think it absolutely factors into the coverage. It factors into how worthwhile we see these women. It factors into how much blame we put on them for their own murders. Certainly there hasn't been extensive coverage of this case in the first place. But some of the comments that I've read, have very much centered on the fact that these women weren't worthy, aren't worthy of coverage because they were sex workers. They invited this upon themselves. What did they expect? Not only to be killed, but then to, in their deaths, not be dignified at all, and to not be considered important enough to write about or, to be on the nightly news or to really thoroughly investigate.
Keith, let me go back to you at NPR and again say, pretty much what I was saying to Brett, which is that nobody sits around and says, well, they're only prostitutes, let's not cover it. But you and I both know that somehow that factors into this, and Brett was saying the same thing. Somehow in the back of our minds, this is part of it. How do you think that decision-making process or those ideas, the worthiness of the victim, the blame, the guilt associated with the victim, plays a part in the decision-making process?
Well, I think it probably in our past journalistically was much more a situation in which we said out loud, not worthy of our coverage. We've evolved, not organizationally, we've evolved journalistically in this country to the point where you don't hear that anymore. I do think it plays a part, probably at this point, especially on a national scale, less so than it might even on the local scale. This story is about, in the end, people who went missing, many of them who were already off the radar of the society that they were operating in, and they have gone missing in significant numbers, and regardless of what their profiles might have been at this point, that story argues for broader coverage.
Brett Chambers, go ahead.
I'm just going to say, I think yes, journalists have to always examine the checkoffs in their heads. We do this with drug murders all the time on a local level. Simply, there's a sentence that says drug related, and once you put that phrase into a story, it vanishes from the rundowns of our news organizations unless there was something extraordinary about the circumstances of the death. And we have to remember always that a life is a life.
Brett Chambers, you talked about the diversity, you know, sort of these decisions get made on a kind of a tribal basis. Who's your group? Is diversity enough? Is there something about the culture of a newsroom that in a sense, turns all reporters into the same kind of creature and forces them to sort of forget their background in a sense? Is it a culture unto itself, reporting?
Yes to both. There is a yes to the culture of reporting and being a journalist, but there's also a yes to diversity in that when you have – first of all, let me back up. There's two things that we have to discuss. Diversity is one thing. That's getting different people with different perspectives at the table, gender, racial, social, economic, getting those to the table. The second part is inclusion, and this is the part that sometimes that does not happen, and that's the part that we need to really make sure we do, even in this environment of downsizing. And that is, once we get people to the table, let's listen to them. If you talk to female reporters, especially some of the old guard that have been in the trenches for a long time, they will tell you the stories of how when they first got there, oh, they would only get certain types of stories, and they wouldn't listen to them about other types of stories. So now women have proven themselves there. African Americans, Hispanic, whichever group that you want to talk about, is once they get in the door, are they listened to and are they respected? And sometimes that doesn't come just because somebody wants to. It's because people demand it. They earn it. So to answer your question, yes, there's a culture, but then there's a culture that we have to make sure we listen to the people that are at the table.
Well, these themes are going to resonate throughout the stories that we talk about today. I'd like to move on now to the story of Felicia Barnes. She lives in Monroe, North Carolina, near Charlotte, with her mother. Over the Christmas holiday, she went to visit her father's family in Baltimore. She went missing from the family home at the end of December. In the beginning of that search, the police criticized the media, and I think this was mostly the national media, for not paying enough attention to the missing girl because she was African American. But I also want to talk about the fact that when this story is reported, the reporting stresses that she was an honor student. And a little bit about her character, Jill. And I wonder if you hear the story and the way this particular story, this description of Felicia, you hear in there a kind of discrimination that we in the media tend to make when we cover and describe victims.
Well, sure, because the assumption is if she's a 16-year-old African-American girl from, you know, in Baltimore for the weekend, that maybe she was a runaway. And the coverage of the story that I've read has repeatedly specified everything that you just said, and also that it's because of all of these factors, it's unlikely that she's running away. You know, you don't really see that in the coverage of, you know, a 16-year-old upper middle class white girl who disappears in Aruba, which isn't a bad thing. You shouldn't see that in the story. Right. But that emphasis on how accomplished Felicia is, that she was a good student, that she was college bound, is clearly being interjected in the story, unfortunately, necessarily, to counter not only media bias, but I think also reader bias and what they assume, you know, a 16-year-old African-American girl who goes missing must be like.
Keith, what do you think? Do we betray our assumptions when we use those qualifiers in describing victims?
Well, I think, in fact, that's the best way of describing it, that what you can't say for sure, and I don't know that I can, is exactly what the assumptions are, but by choice of details in any of these cases, the things that we choose to tell people to identify the folks who are missing always reveal something, whether it's intended to counteract a stereotype or whether it's based on a notion that this information will elicit more sympathy and therefore more action than if she were an average student. Is what that's in the minds of the people who are offering you these descriptions. I think a lot of times in our journalism, that goes unexamined, and it comes out of our mouths, it comes off of the page with an assumption that everybody who's part of this communication understands things the same way. And just the fact that in this conversation, our interpretations of those facts might be different tells you that journalistically it's not a particularly sound practice.
And Keith, you make a really good point. And also, it's that whole traditional way that we view things. It's yes, beyond the stereotypes, because just because you have an African-American reporter in the newsroom doesn't mean they're going to report on African-American issues, and nor should they. The one thing we want to have, the reason why we want to have that diversity is so that everybody have the sharing of perspectives, so that there's a discussion and a dialogue before the stories even, before they get covered, then after they get covered, and then a review of how they were covered. And the really good newsrooms, they do that, even when it's painful. And there have been times, there was a story in Durham a number of years ago that I use as an example in class for this kind of thing, where the station reported that there was white women being attacked in northern Durham. But they never said how they were attacked, why they were attacked, or anything. And some of us made a point to the newsroom, hey, either provide more details to the story or pull it, because it's going to cause some problems. And all we did was ask, who are the attackers? And everybody to a person said, black males. But it was the attackers were never identified. So it's this whole idea of the stereotypes and how do we counteract those with real information and real facts, and how do we keep the context and the framing. And there's a book called News Coverage of Violence Against Women Endangering Blame, Marion Myers. And she talks about this throughout her book, about blaming the victim. And she does a real good analysis of the stereotypes that journalists have just from a day-to-day operational point of view, just being a human being in this society, and then how they try to counteract that when they're in the newsroom. But it's that whole idea that the fact you have to counteract it at all, right, is a problem.
Well, and Jill, and when you counteract it, then you, in a sense, reinforce the stereotype. And I'll put this in the form of a question. Do you think that that's what happens when we emphasize the goodness of the worthiness of the victim, particularly when it's a woman?
Yeah, that's exactly what happens. You know, so journalists are, I think, very much stuck in sort of a catch-22 where, in order to make a case like Felicia's notable and to get people to pay attention, you have to emphasize that, you know, she's a 16-year-old girl, she's an honors student, she's a great student, so that any parent watching feels like that could be my daughter. But you know, in doing that, then you end up with situations like we have in the Rocky Mountain case, where those women are also somebody's daughters, but maybe they're not quite as easily relatable because of what their profession is, and because they do sort of live on the margins of society.
Keith Woods, does that become the job of the journalist then to create that context without making a kind of comparison, showing that it matters because it's a human life, not because it's a particularly worthy life, a track star, a ballerina, or whatever?
Well, sure, and you go back to news judgment 101 in our journalism schools, and they'll tell you that the fact that she is an honors student ought to be offered up as one of the descriptors of her. The point that I guess I'm making here is that if you're going to offer me any information in profile of anybody, then I ought to be able to see clearly why it is that you're telling me that. If you're saying, for example, that she's an honors student and statistically honors students don't run away, then that's a fact-based reason for including information. It's when we operate based on assumptions that don't ultimately make their way into the rigors of journalism that you wind up with these kinds of distinctions. And again, the fact that somebody has gone about killing women in Rocky Mount in the way that appears to have been happening is a story regardless of what their station in life might be. I'll say one more thing, because it's so important to me as you talk about media coverage, that if the police in any jurisdiction aren't on the job, if they're not putting the resources toward trying to figure something out, that's a story, and you tell that story. It becomes part of the story of any particular case. But if they are on a case, sometimes, in fact, the community isn't galvanizing around a missing person in one case the way that they do in another, and that throws off stories that journalists then cover in one community but don't cover in another community. And it will often play out by both race and class but it may have little to do with either.
We will continue our conversation about media coverage, whose stories get told and whose don't. On the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, please stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking this hour about what's missing from mass media news stories. My guests are Keith Woods, Vice President for Diversity in News and Operations at NPR. Jill Filipovic is a New York-based lawyer and blogger for the site Feminist. Brett Chambers is a lecturer in English and Mass Communications at North Carolina Central University. Next story I want to consider is from Georgia. It occurred in December, just before Christmas, for 6 days. Six different prisons in Georgia. Inmates went on strike. They refused to leave their cells and report for work. The strikers wanted to call attention to abusive treatment, poor living conditions, and the nearly complete lack of pay for their work. It is possible that this is the first time you're hearing about this story. And if you've heard about it at all, you haven't heard much. It's remarkable because of the way it was well organized. It was nonviolent. It went on for 6 days, and it was scarcely mentioned outside the state of Georgia. Keith, Brett, and Jill, let me start with you, Brett. Did you hear anything about this?
Yeah, because I read the Triangle Tribune, and Mark Anthony Neal's a friend of mine. So I was on, so I was on his blog, and you know, it's that whole idea that now you have micro news. You have micro audiences. You have micro, all the bloggers that do affinity blogging because they write about specific things. And it just shows that the news operations, whether local or national, are really aggregating now, aggregating information, because the Triangle Tribune is a local paper in Durham, but they share resources with the Charlotte Post because they're all owned by one company. And so they're reaching out to address their audience, the minority audience primarily, but they're providing news that the News and Observer may not cover because they don't have the same responsibility, the same connection, the same affinity, the same tribe. So, yes, the Triangle Tribune and those kinds of papers need to still, they have a purpose to bring us the stuff that the other papers don't bring us.
Right. But here's the thing. And you talk about Mark Anthony Neal, professor of African American studies at Duke. I read his blog and I read the Triangle Tribune. And that's the only reason I knew about it. Keith, why wasn't the story on NPR?
Well, I think we would have to talk to our news leaders to answer that question. is it a national story? I think, like many of the most interesting things that happen around this country, I could argue easily for any number of them to make national news. It's a fascinating story, frankly, given what we know about the history of prison uprisings in the country. It's an ongoing story, so it's not like it's a story that you couldn't still visit today.
Jill, had you heard about this story back in December?
I actually hadn't, which is odd because I do follow quite a few prison abolitionist writers and people who cover the criminal justice system pretty extensively. So I hadn't heard about this at all until about 2 days ago when I was emailed links for this segment, which I think speaks to just how little the story was actually covered outside of the local media.
No, there were prisoners who sat down. This is a nonviolent strike. No one was injured. Prisoners simply refused to work, and they managed to communicate among each other, I think, by using the illegal cell phones. So they were texting each other and absolutely organized a sit-down strike, nonviolent, shut down the prison system. There were outside negotiators who were working for the inmates, and negotiations were going on with the prison system. It's an extraordinary event, and we didn't hear about it. Why do you think that is? What about this story? Because there was a tiny, tiny piece 3 days after the first incident that appeared in the New York Times. It was the second page on my Google search once I found it in the Triangle Tribune. But why don't you think it was picked up? Let me start with you, Brett.
It depends on what was going on. I mean, sometimes there's so much other stuff. There's so much information to aggregate and then put out there. And the fact that it was in the New York Times, it's a matter of how many people actually paid attention to it. So we know that newsrooms read newspapers, because I mainly talk about television and radio stations. They read newspapers. They read blogs. They read all. So they had the same opportunity that you did. You know, it's just a matter of did it resonate with them? And I like Keith's word. It's about the you know, the resonating, and that comes in that whole affinity group kind of deal, and also, you know, the what I used earlier as a tribal message. But it's that whole idea of, does it resonate? And if it doesn't, you know, the fire down the street may resonate more because it's more local. And if it's a national story, you know, you have all this unrest in overseas. So things tend to be more sexy. And I'm, you know, like most of us, we're probably getting tired of seeing Charlie Sheen, and we could probably replace some of the other news.
A little bit.
Yeah. So it's that whole idea of what resonates with people and what do they think the audience want to see. And I think that you bringing it up today, somebody's going to pick that up.
Well, they didn't pick it up from the New York Times, Keith, and I kind of wonder what, how much this has to do, and maybe other stories that we've talked about, with the total shrinkage of the number of boots on the ground, the number of reporters who are out reporting the news versus bloggers and opinion leaders.
I think we have to take two different tacks to this. One is that I think we can agree, in general, that a story like this is fascinating enough, interesting enough, resonant enough to make it into a national news program. But I don't think that that alone determines whether or not it got in on that day or that week. I mean, as you know, there's a lot in the New York Times every week, every day, some of which everybody thinks is an important story, some of which measures up to the news of the day, all of the other things that might be possible. So I want to stop short of saying that the fact that it wasn't on the air is evidence of any particular malady, even as we can agree that there are a lot of stories that aren't getting covered for some of the reasons that we've been articulating here today. You know, the boots on the ground piece of it for us, I mean, is for our industry is important. But that unto itself wouldn't explain a whole lot. The story was available to people. It got around.
And it still is. I mean, I think that's the other question. The fact that it didn't get in and it was around Christmas time and all of that. But the fact that it is an ongoing story, that they're still dealing with this and we still haven't seen much coverage, it still remains kind of an interesting question to me.
Well, sure. I mean, but, you know, I would venture that if I were to take a guess about what was going on in the story meetings in December, that there's a better than average chance that somebody brought this up, and perhaps it was weighed against other stories and different choices were made. I can't say for sure.
And I'd like to say that we still have to also go back to the whole national versus local piece, because if WRL, TVD, or 17 all looked at the Georgia piece, when they have the Wake County school system situations over there going on, that's not going to be a very hard choice for them. They're going to pick the Wake County school situation. And that's going to get a lot more coverage than a Georgia prison uprising. And so from a local standpoint, it's not as big a story until it becomes a national ABC piece and there's a local connection. And then if there's a local connection, then it becomes a higher priority for this market. And I think that that's one of the things that we have to understand is that that there's only so much time that they can even allot. But then here's the great equalizer. And it's the part that you talked about, and I don't think we can really overlook this. You saw Mark Anthony Neal's blog carried by the Triangle Tribune. And when we talk about boots on the ground, the way outlets and are trying to deal with this is they're looking at the credible bloggers who are just like credible. Some of them are just as good as some of the credible reporters. So they're looking at places that can provide information that is credible and they have a history of credibility so that they're using citizen journalism as a way to supplement that boots on the ground syndrome.
Well, Jill, that was supposed to, the citizen journalism was supposed to increase the number and the amount and the diversity in the kind of reporting that we got. But because of all the echoes that you hear in the tweets and in the blogs, does it seem to you that maybe we've shrunk our breadth in terms of the kind of coverage we're getting?
Well, I think that we increased the breadth of coverage that we have. I think what's decreased has been the individual face-to-face reporting. I mean, obviously, I'm a blogger. I'm a big fan of new media. I think many bloggers do great work. But what most bloggers do is, you know, either aggregating content that somebody else is producing originally or commenting on the journalistic work that someone else has done. And that commentary is very important, especially, you know, when it comes to bloggers that are experts on certain very narrow areas. You know, you can find a feminist voice to speak on, you know, topics like we're speaking about today. You can find somebody who's an expert on healthcare policy. You can find someone who's an expert on prisons. But you have to have somebody who is doing the journalistic work of going in and reporting these stories in the first place. Some bloggers do that, but most of us don't have the bankroll or the institutional support to really go out there and report the stories firsthand. So, you know, while I'm obviously a big proponent of blogging and of new media, I don't think that it's really responsible for bloggers who do the kind of work that I personally do, which is just to comment on stories and to give our opinion, to brand ourselves, you know, as citizen journalists or reporters. Right. I mean, we're commentators, but I'm not going into a prison in Georgia and interviewing inmates.
Well, that's the thing. Somebody has to do the primary
coverage. Somebody has to do that.
Right. Yeah, and now one story that the media has not had any trouble covering, of course, is the attack and the sexual assault on CBS News correspondent Lara Logan, assaulted during the celebrations following the fall of Hosni Mubarak in Egypt. That happened in Tahrir Square last month. She was rescued. She's now recovering in New York. Jill, so many aspects of this story that are disturbing. What is most troubling to you?
I mean, I guess it's been the 1-2 punch of sexism and Islamophobia that we've seen coming out of this story, that there's blame put on Lara Logan for why did she put herself there in the first place, you know, and then this kind of backhanded way of talking about her Hollywood good looks and how she's so beautiful, and then also talking about the men that attacked her and emphasizing that, you know, there are these Muslim animals who, of course, couldn't keep their hands off of this beautiful blonde reporter. You know, so really dehumanizing both Lara Logan and, you know, these men who are criminals and, you know, who did a horrible thing, but who certainly didn't do it because of their religion or their ethnicity.
Brett Chambers?
I was going to echo what she just said, because I think that there is, it's one of those things where we rally around our colleague. On one hand, because it's a huge story, because she's one of us, she's a journalist, and how dare anybody touch a journalist? And it's that sense of entitlement that sometimes we just have. I mean, that's just what it is. And then it's the feedback of that whole idea of, well, she put herself in harm's way. Nobody said that about Bob Woodward. You know, it's a shame what happened to both of them. Mm-hmm. But nobody, you know, talked about his Hollywood good looks or his newscaster good looks.
Cooper Anderson, Anderson Cooper, mean?
No, from ABC.
Yeah.
When he got shot.
All right. I thought you were right, because Anderson Cooper was also attacked during those terms.
But I wanted to go back a little bit
to
separate the two just a little bit to give it some distance. But it's that whole idea that when Woodward got, you know, he almost died. And nobody said—
Woodruff, you mean.
Woodruff, I'm sorry. Thank you. Yeah. Nobody talked about his looks or why did he put himself in that position. There was a different kind of outpouring of sympathy or empathy even. So there's still some of that in the newsroom, and newsrooms nationally and locally, but I think in some ways it's gotten better, because there are people that are to do the stops, to go up and say, hey, you should not do it this way. We shouldn't report it this way, because we have, one, more women in the newsroom, men who are more aware of the feministic ideas and the right and wrong and the ethics and all that. The same way we have African-American news managers that say, no, we're not going to report it that way. Let's have some more facts before we put this story out. So I think that, and we have more responsible news managers, period, okay, because they're more sensitized to it. So I think that there's some benefit to having these discussions about it, because once we discuss it, then we can kind of see some of where the wrinkles are and try to smooth those out, or try not to make those same mistakes.
Keith Woods, what do you make of the coverage of this story?
Well, I'll just add a couple of more angles to it. First of all, we did get a sense, especially from the broadcast media, that this ought not be happening to journalists. In that sort of indignation that Brett's talking about, I think that there actually is a point to be made there, though, that has to do with the courageous work that journalists were doing and continue to do in that region, And the consequences to the informed public when the journalists themselves are targeted, as they were in Egypt, as they were in Bahrain, as they've been in Libya. And that's an important point to make, whether or not it's Anderson Cooper or somebody else making it. Here's one more important point, though, in a Laura Logan case. One of the things that came out, and I read in a piece by Kim Barker of ProPublica that made this point, is that there were many women who have been, assaulted being the strong word, and I won't try to use a lesser one, not just in this story, but often on the job, especially out in the field, who don't tell their bosses about this for fear that the newsroom bosses will say, oh, it's too dangerous to send you, and pull them off the story. That's another conversation that we need to be having in journalism, even today, about that kind of knee-jerk reaction that we can have sometimes, especially when you read a story about sexual assault, because it hits some triggers in our societal mind that sometimes makes us not think very clearly about what the decisions are that we make next. And I thought that piece really pointed that out.
And Jill, I only have about 30 seconds left, but this also does point to the idea that women are sexually assaulted every minute of every day, and it's the high-profile assaults that seem to make the news. I mean, how do you feel about that?
Right. I mean, you know, there was a study that came out maybe about a year ago about incidences of sexual harassment and assault in Egypt on the streets, you know, towards Egyptian women in Cairo. And you didn't really hear, I mean, obviously, you know, you wouldn't maybe hear as much about that in the U.S. media. But even in through the lens of the Laura Logan case, you aren't hearing about what Egyptian women go through every day, average women who don't have the same platform. You know, and hopefully the Logan case can be a jumping off point to talk about the day-to-day harassment women face, but also the kind of unique access that female journalists get and how valuable that is.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Jill Filipovic is a New York-based lawyer and blogger for the site Feminist. Keith Woods, Vice President for Diversity in News and Operations at NPR. And also with us is Brett Chambers, a lecturer in English and Mass Communications at North Carolina Central. Thank all of you for being
thank
on the program
you.
Today.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.